this hour of the Jason Rand Show, brought to you by You Build It. Lots of news is happening all around the world and right here at home. So let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? The coronavirus.
So the Tacoma Rainiers return to Cheney Stadium for the first time in 21 months, and you're going to get to join them and take advantage of the Governor Inslee approved vaccinated only sections.
It's a very significant moment for us internally. If we can stand out and take a little heat, but lead, and it does inspire more people to get vaccinated, we're doing our part.
You see, that is the president of the Rainiers, Aaron Artman, talking to King 5. He says they want to be the leaders in their community.
I think it's important to lead in this scenario, particularly in Pierce County, where there's danger of us going back to phase one. And if you look at the data, where the most cases are in Pierce County also have the lowest vaccination rates, and those two are correlated.
So the Rainiers are the first private company mandating a vaccine passport, as it were, to enter the vaccinated-only section. This is allowed under the new guidance coming from the governor's office. And it's not just about the businesses that are able to do this under certain circumstances. Colleges are mandating it as well. Although in this case, you've got, starting in the new semester, students at both public and private colleges requiring students to show proof of COVID vaccinations in order to attend. We're talking about the University of Washington, Wazoo, PLU, Evergreen, Central, and some others. You might still have to wear masks, though, which doesn't quite make sense. Staff at the University of Washington and Pacific Lutheran University, not so much. They actually don't have to get vaccinated. So is any of this legal? And if it is, under what authority? There are a lot of questions that some of you guys have answered. I don't quite have all the answers. Joining me on the line to discuss is former Washington State Attorney General Rob McKenna. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jason.
So obviously two separate issues here when dealing with a private company versus the public schools. Let's talk about it just from the public colleges and even the high schools for a moment. Now, obviously, none of these vaccines yet are approved by the FDA. They're all considered safe, but they have been granted the use under the emergency use authorization only. So can a public college or even a high school mandate them?
It appears they can, but that hasn't been tested in court yet. So there are arguments being made right now by plaintiffs who have lost their jobs because they refused to become vaccinated, that approval of these vaccines under emergency use authorizations isn't sufficient. The problem they have in those lawsuits, and the problem that a college student would have pushing back against the University of Washington's requirement, for example, is that the language in the emergency use authorization for each of these vaccines doesn't speak to employers or to colleges. And so it's pretty clear that the federal government can't require every citizen to go out and get vaccinated. But, you know, we have at-will employment in this country, and we have people making voluntary choices to enroll in certain schools. So it may be that employers and colleges do have the authority to require people to provide proof of vaccination.
Well, you made the point of at will. What does that matter here? There are students who obviously enrolled in a school before this mandate was in place.
That's true, but you know, conditions change. So they're not grandfathered in because they enrolled before the mandate came in. It's not like people weren't aware that the vaccinations were becoming available and weren't aware that universities and colleges have been pretty major sites for spreading the virus. So if you're the college, the university, or the employer, you have to also think about, like, what do I need to do to reduce my own liability, right? What is the burden on me as an institution if people are allowed to come back without proof of vaccination and a super spreader event results or some spreading results? So they're wrestling with it from that point of view as well.
Yeah. Now, let me play devil's advocate. I am going into my senior year at a school. The expectation was when I signed up to go here as a freshman, which was pre-pandemic, I would not be forced into taking on an experimental vaccine that has not been approved yet by the FDA. Don't I have a reasonable expectation to not be mandated into taking this?
Well, that'll be weighed against the public health rationale for requiring students at universities, including the seniors, to get vaccinated. And while the vaccines are available under an EUA, and therefore technically still experimental, we all know that hundreds and hundreds of millions of doses have been administered and have been proven to be effective and very, very safe. I mean, nothing is perfectly safe. Obviously, you can have a few adverse results in a million, but the idea that, well, it's experimental, therefore I shouldn't have to get it, is really weakened by the fact that these vaccines have been so widely deployed and successfully deployed, for that matter.
Does it matter, and does the court take into consideration the fact that an 18 to 21-year-old college-age student, when it comes to COVID, is not considered at risk? That when you look at the data, you know, the risk of hospitalization, including if you've got even two or three comorbidities, the hospitalization rate is a tenth of a percentage point, which is matching the same for the risk of death. Does that matter?
Yeah, well, yeah. Thank goodness that young people generally don't get sick from COVID, so that's a good thing. But they can be carriers. So, you know, they can spread it to people who are older, who are on campus, or people they encounter off campus who are older. And I think that's one of the rationales for requiring them to get vaccinated.
And again, this is me playing devil's advocate. The University of Washington nor Pacific Lutheran require staff members who do, in fact, fall into the risky category that you just point out. They're not being forced into taking the vaccine.
And I think it comes down to I think that's a good point, and I think it's inconsistent. In fact, I noticed in one news report that the labor unions in our state, ironically including the union that represents grocery store, healthcare, and retail store workers, don't want a vaccine mandate for workers, even though they're demanding hazard pay for workers because they're more exposed to the virus. That strikes me as inconsistent. The Washington State Labor Council, which represents unions all over the state, just outright opposes vaccine requirements. And what I read, Jason, you may have more up-to-date information, but I read in an article that I read for this interview that the University of Washington, which does have over 46,000 employees, is still determining whether a vaccine can or will be required. It seems to me it would be more consistent for them to require it. At the same time, those employees are employees, or they're not there because they're interacting with students. So it's not the same argument that you would make for teachers
perhaps
vaccinated. But it is an inconsistency. I agree with you there.
Does that actually matter, though? Does the inconsistency matter as far as the legality of this is concerned? So if a student were to go up there and say, look, I don't want to take this because of the inconsistency, does a court look at that?
Possibly. I mean, if you're asserting a liberty interest, you know, a constitutional right not to be forced to do something, and you're saying, look, why am I being required to do this when similarly situated people, i.e. other people at the University of Washington, are not being required? What is the rational basis for that? Is it just that the university doesn't want to take on the unions? Is that enough of a basis to impose different requirements depending on how you're situated? It's a very important and interesting question. It'll be interesting to see if any student tests that.
The other thing I think is going to be kind of interesting is you also have students who are employees of the University of Washington. So where they end up falling within this, if you're going to say that staff members, because the language I got back from the Washington, from the UW at least, saying, well, we're still trying to figure this out as we have these conversations. Well, you've got some that overlap. They're both. And so where do they stand? So then are you now saying some students don't have to get it?
Well, that makes the student's case who's not an employee of the university even stronger, doesn't it? Like, the only difference is I'm not employed by the university, but my fellow student who is exempt from this requirement. What's the rational basis for that? Look, if this mandate is being imposed under an emergency order of some sort, it does. Emergency orders, as we've seen for the last year or more, do give government a lot of power. But there are limits to it. The government doesn't get to do anything it wants without review. There has to at least be a rational basis for making distinctions between similarly situated people and whether they're subject to a mandate. Rational basis is not a very high standard to meet because there's going to be deference to given. Although typically what we see there is when it's the city of Seattle imposing a requirement, you know, it's they'll say, well, there's rational basis. It may be different for employers, and it may be different for higher education universities, because they may not be operating under emergency powers. They may just be imposing requirements that they think they need to protect their own interests, which include protecting other people on campus. It's just that that argument is undermined when they're not requiring everybody who comes on campus to work or go to school be vaccinated. It just looks like a major inconsistency.
Last question for you. Does any of this matter when it comes, when you look at high schoolers?
We've had a long tradition in this country of requiring public school students to be vaccinated to come to school, so I don't think it makes much difference. The thing there is that only recently have vaccines been approved under an EUA for 16-year-olds, or now I guess it may go back to as young as 11. But I think that the power of the public schools to require students to be vaccinated is pretty well established and is not likely to be different in this case.
Yeah, the one I do wonder if, as the science behind COVID and the scientific consensus is starting to shift, and there was a New York Times piece earlier this week that we've been spending a lot of time talking about, where they seem to believe now that we're not going to get to herd immunity, that it's not likely, it's not even reasonable, and that the tragic irony in all of this is we're going to start treating COVID like the flu in the way we deal with it. Essentially, we get everybody who's as vulnerable, that we view as vulnerable, we're going to get them vaccinated. Everybody else will get vaccinated as best as possible, but we're just going to mitigate the effects. I do wonder if that plays a role in the mass vaccinations that are required on campuses, just because we don't mandate flu shots on college campuses or on high school campuses. And we know that COVID does not impact younger people even remotely the same way as older people. And I'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't think there's a clear answer to it. I mean, COVID is clearly more dangerous in older people. So if younger people are relatively safe from it, then why require a vaccine for them when we don't require a flu vaccine? The answer may be COVID is still more dangerous, even for young people, than the flu is, and that we're still concerned about younger people taking it home and exposing their parents and grandparents and so forth. So that might be a rationale. And, you know, the fact is we've lost a lot of people in this country to COVID, far more than we've lost to the flu. And that does set this virus apart, particularly when you consider that, like the flu, the virus continues to mutate. So where we think we are today may not be where we find ourselves by this time next year.
Well, we'll see. Only time will tell, obviously. Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General. Thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it, as always.
Absolutely a pleasure, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you. Don't forget, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/JasonRants. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending at home?
It's time to reopen Washington State, or at least it's getting to that point. There is a petition that says, let's get this ball rolling. Let's actually get a plan in place. The petition being started by the Washington Hospitality Association, their CEO, Anthony Antone, joins me now. Anthony, you'd like to see Governor Inslee reopen the state, have our restaurants open, really have our economy reopen by June 14th. Take us through your thinking.
You know, it's now time, and we really are excited to have a date that makes sense, that aligns with all the things we've been talking about are important, and get our economy going again. And while we were very appreciative that the governor on Tuesday didn't roll us backwards, a lot of his quotes indicated we don't have a plan to move forward.
Yeah.
And that struck all of us after we listened to the press conference, and our team was talking about the same time the news that came through about New York and New Jersey and Connecticut all announced plans to reopen on May 19th. And we're like, well, where are all the other states on moving forward? And we started doing the research and really learned that 48 other states already either are open or have a plan to move forward. And so only us and Hawaii are the two states that don't have a plan to move forward. Even California has a plan to move forward on June 15th.
You know, I don't mean this as a snarky question, but does that shock you with the governor? You know, have you at any point during the last year Has the governor struck you as someone who has figured this out?
I think there are a lot of people have viewed opening or reopening as a partisan issue. And so I thought with roughly, I think it's 19 Democratic governors across the country, that there would be other states that would have a similar opinion. And so the fact that we're really down to two did surprise me, to be honest with you. I thought a lot of this reopening has been kind of talked about business versus other.
Mm-hmm.
And yet to see so many states with the Democratic governors say it's come to be time, I think emboldens us the chance that this is a fair ask. And California is announced June 15th. If we reopened on June 15th, that's a set date. It's a date that we can start planning for all the things we've missed. The weddings that people have been delaying can have a date and talk about how their families come to them. And people who have their kids graduating, my son graduated last year and we missed it because of what happened.
Yep.
And I don't want that to have another round of families this year. If we set a date, high schools and families can start making plans. People can start planning for travel around our state. And yet by doing it in June, the worry about are enough people vaccinated will be gone, because by that time, everybody who wants a shot will have had one. So that's why I think this is an opportunity we should be excited about. And I'm hoping as many people sign the petition as we can to let the governor know, we'll be with you, governor. I know you might be nervous about reopening and is it safe, but the Washingtonians are telling you it's okay. And it is now time to move forward.
So where can people sign the petition?
I would love for you, if you're willing to share it on your website, because it's got one of those silly names, but it's p2a.co/reopenwa.
How about this? I'm going to make it even easier. If you text the keyword RANTS, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770, I will send you a direct link where you can actually sign this thing. Text the keyword RANTZ to 1-800-465-8770, and I'll send you a link so you can sign it. Let's get this economy back open again. We have been talking with the Washington Hospitality Association CEO, Anthony Antone. Anthony, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for doing that and all you're doing, and I'm looking forward to seeing all your listeners in our restaurants here on June 16th.
Absolutely. Fingers crossed for that. Again, text the keyword RANTS to 1-800-465-8770. Let's get Washington State back open again. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770, KTTH, and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. You've likely heard the ads on KTTH. I'm going to be the MC for an inspirational event over at the Lincoln Theater in Mount Vernon on Saturday, June 12th, all in support of Helping Hands Food Bank. It's called Leaders Inspiring Leaders, an evening with Dr. Robert Gates. It's going to feature the former Secretary of Defense, stories from his amazing career, all to help raise awareness for Helping Hands. Limited tickets are on sale. They're on sale right now at helpinghandsfoodbank.org. Secretary Gates, welcome back to the show. It's actually been a while. You've been on the show one time a couple years ago.
Well, we don't want it to get too old.
I know. I feel old myself. So what can we expect from you on June 12th? Because when we say sort of generally you're going to be telling stories, how do you even begin?
Well, I think there will be some anecdotes about my time as Secretary of Defense and also as Director of CIA. But also in leading Texas A&M University and other institutions. But what I really want to do is tie some of those leadership lessons back to the extraordinary leadership and performance demonstrated by the folks at the Helping Hands Food Bank here in Skagit County, and particularly what they've done since the onset of the pandemic now 15 months ago.
How has COVID just impacted all of this? When we talk about being a leader for a community, you get hit with a pandemic. Obviously, no one expected it. You're already doing really tough work in a community, and then a pandemic hits. How does that impact it all?
Well, and just in the case of Helping Hands, so here's an organization that made do with a number of volunteers from the local community in Cedro Woolley, and basically serving the citizens of the Cedro Woolley area. And all of a sudden, come the pandemic, the huge increase in demand for services. And all of a sudden, this food bank is supporting communities from Concrete and Marble Mount upriver all the way to Anacortes. And instead of a handful or a number of volunteers, they've got three dozen National Guardsmen, men and women, helping them in the distribution. So it all of a sudden becomes a massive leadership and management enterprise of not only acquiring many times as much food as was required before, but also managing a distribution system and creating it out of whole cloth, brand new. If that's not great leadership, I don't know what is.
And sometimes it really does take, and you know this, it takes a tragedy to build that kind of leadership, or really just bring out the leadership qualities in people.
Well, that's right, and I think that that we've seen that in the leadership and Helping Hands. But I think you know, just watching the news from around the region, we've seen that in a number of different not just food banks, but other organizations in the northwest corner of the state helping people who have been impacted by the pandemic, and not just the need for food, but unemployment and the consequences of illness and everything else.
HelpingHandsFoodBank.org. That's where you go right now if you want to purchase tickets to this event. The proceeds actually go to Helping Hands Food Bank. HelpingHandsFoodBank.org. I'll be the MC for the event. How do I introduce you, Secretary Gates? You've got such a background. What do I do? Where do I start?
Well, I think a place to start would be here's a local citizen who thinks the world of Helping Hands and tries to do what he and his wife can to help in our own way.
How many jokes can I bring up in there? Because I get a little snarky. I can be a little controversial. I'm a Fox News guy. Can I throw some of that in there, or do I have to stay completely, you know, uncontroversial?
You know, I spent nearly 30 years testifying in front of Congress. I don't think that you've got fastball that'll be a stranger to me.
There you go. So let's talk a little bit about some of the stuff that's going on out there that is a little bit controversial, but I know that, you know, you've obviously been navigating a lot of this stuff. It kind of feels like every other day, whether you're looking at the Department of Defense or the CIA or really any agency, there's some story of that intersection where national security meets cultural issues. And depending on one's perspective, it's either a story about the error of wokeness or simply the changing needs of an agency because you have to recruit different generations. So how should these different agencies navigate these waters of recruiting younger demographics without going too far?
Well, I think that you have to be adaptable. I mean, when I joined CIA 55 years ago, if you had ever smoked a single marijuana cigarette, if you ever smoked a single joint, you were disqualified. You couldn't be in CIA. If they had continued that practice into the 90s and the early 2000s, the building would be empty. So that's a place where they adapted. I changed the rules in 1992 so that we could recruit gay men and women to the agency. And the only consideration was they had to be open about their orientation so they couldn't be blackmailed. But that was an adjustment because there were a lot of places we were being denied the opportunity to recruit because of our previous policies. So I think you have to adapt to the times. And, you know, sometimes you can go a little overboard in trying to be too hip. but I think the bottom line is the same line that should be applied to the military, and that is anyone who can meet the standards and can get through the training and can pass the security test should be welcome to serve, no matter what any of their personal characteristics may be.
So how do you know when you've gone too far? Because that's actually kind of curious to me, because I look on the one hand, for example, at the CIA recruitment video of an intersectional progressive, and that looks like a parody. And then on the other hand, I look at today's decision announced by the Army saying it's okay to wear a ponytail, and that seems completely legitimate, and that offers no concerns on my behalf. So from your perspective as an insider, where do you think things kind of go in that, you know, going a little bit too far, what's your bar, I guess?
Well, pretty good rule of thumb is that when everyone left and right is laughing at you, you've probably gone too far.
That's actually a really good place to be, although sometimes it's, and you know this, it's so polarizing, one side says it's gone too far, and the other side, just because the other side says it gone too far, the other side said, nope, we are instinctively going to say you're wrong. So we'll see. I'm looking forward to this event on June 12th because you've got a lot of wisdom in you. You've got a lot of great stories. You've experienced so much, and I'm so pumped to hear what you have to say. HelpingHandsFoodBank.org. Go there to learn about an amazing organization. Send some money their way because they're doing some great work. And while you're there, make sure you purchase tickets for this event on June 12th. It's out in Mount Vernon at the Lincoln Theater. It's called Leaders, Inspiring Leader. Just click on the event page, purchase your tickets, come hang out with Secretary Gates. And of course, me, I'll be there, but it's really all about Secretary Gates. Thank you so much, sir, for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. I look forward to seeing you next month.
I look forward to it as well. Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show on AM 770 KTTH. There was a curious story with a headline that caught my attention over at our sister website, MyNorthwest.com. And it caught my attention because, of course, I am pretty in tune with the stories on policing. And whenever we talk about defunding and Seattle, I like to make sure that I know where all the council members are coming from, where their heads are at. And Nick Bowman, my friend there, says a year later, more questions than answers over Seattle Council's stance on defunding SPD. And it's curious because while I don't necessarily agree with the fact that there are more questions than answers per se, I was curious enough to click on it. And I loved how Nick Bowman framed this, because his point was you have all these council members, almost the entirety of which, supported this 50% defund movement. They decided to kowtow to the anti-police activists, with the exception of Deborah Juarez and Alex Peterson, this 50% defund promise. They said, we're all in. And they voted to defund. And then, of course, they didn't deliver. They delivered on 20%. Which, of course, did not satisfy the crowd, the activist crowd, who, for the most part, want to completely dismantle the police department. And now we're a year later, and they still have no plan. And in fact, they're not even really talking about it anymore. They're still trying to dismantle and defund, but they're not screaming about defunding by 50% anymore. They've kind of just forgotten that. And the activist crowd has died down as it was a year ago, obviously. It's not what it once was. And so Nick smartly reached out to all the council members. I say smartly, maybe naively. I don't do that anymore because I know they don't ever respond to specific direct questions on their positions because they don't have specific positions anymore. Every time that they speak, it's done specifically to placate the crowd that's the angriest. And he found that out. He found it out. Because he simply asked three questions. Number one, do you currently support defunding the Seattle Police Department by 50%? And why or why not? Number two, what do you see as the biggest priorities for reforming the Seattle Police Department in the near term? And number three, what do you see as the biggest priorities for reform long term? Now, only two council members responded. Lisa Herbold, who's an anti-cop lunatic, who is a liar when she ran, of course, for re-election on the council. She said she backed the cops. She was lying. She immediately voted to defund police officers and try to get them fired after, as a candidate, saying that she wanted to hire more. And Alex Peterson, who is consistent on this, he didn't try to defund them, and so kudos to him. Everybody else didn't respond with answers. Nothing. Dan Strauss's office initially said that they were going to give a response, but then later decided to pass. Because Dan Strauss is a coward. He's always been a coward. He will do whatever he can not to put anything in writing because he doesn't want anything to bite him on the backside when he runs for re-election. Teresa Mosqueda's office, who is running for re-election, and she's trying to pretend, and she's going to continue to pretend that she's not the extremist that she is. She said, oh, I'm too busy. I got so many meetings to get to. She's the one, by the way, who defended a man who screamed out death threats towards cops. You've got Lorena Gonzalez, who didn't respond, even though she's running for mayor, and she was one of the leading advocates to defund. Shama Sawan, who just wants to abolish police, essentially, didn't respond. These people are cowards. Tammy Morales, a socialist who gets mad when you call her a socialist, didn't respond. Andrew Lewis didn't respond. Cowards. Total cowards. And yet, when you've got a whole bunch of angry people demanding you defund, they will, regardless of what it means to the city and to the morale of the police department, they'll be all in. And it's caused their stunt, their despicable actions, it has caused so many officers to leave the department in huge numbers. The mass exodus continues at the SPD. And they're looking for somewhere else to go. Which is why the Bellevue Police Department, in part, is offering $16,000 in a signing bonus to join their force. Joining me on the line to discuss is the Bellevue Police Chief, Steve Milette. Chief Milette, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks for having me.
So how does this work? Who actually is eligible for these pretty significant bonuses?
They are significant. You have to be a commissioned officer. There's a time requirement. I think you have to be 2 years as a peace officer. And then what we do is when the person signs on and they go through the background and we hire them, we give them a $5,000 piece of the bonus. When they complete the FTO program, they get another $5,000. And then when they complete their probationary period, they get $6,000. And it seems to have been very effective in the past, and we're hoping that it's going to be effective again this time.
And this, of course, is on top of the fact that for just a base pay, you're making $100,000.
You know, officers are doing okay. Now, you got to put in the context of the region that we live in and the cost of living up here. But, yeah, $100,000 is a lot of money.
So are you doing this because you're having trouble recruiting officers, or are you doing this as a way to recruit some of the officers who maybe are unhappy at the Seattle Police Department?
Well, I'm not going to go there about the Seattle Police Department. We will take qualified officers wherever we can get them. We had several officers, several senior officers decide to retire. Some were expected, some were unexpected, and our vacancy number right now is hovering about 13, and it's about to go into 14, possibly 15. And for a department our size, that's a problem. So we're using all the tools that we have available to us, and with the support of our city council and, of course, our city manager, Brad Miyake, we got approved to offer the bonus, and and I'm hoping to get that number down to zero because we were successful last year, right before COVID, getting our vacancy number down to zero.
So I guess let me rephrase then the first part of my question. How long have these vacancies been there versus are you being proactive in just trying to get these filled as quickly as humanly possible, or are you doing this because there's been a little bit of a lag in filling those positions?
No, this is this popped up here recently you know, we usually hover around 3, 4, 5 vacancies at any given time, but it really spiked into the double digits here recently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so like I said, some officers have decided to retire before I think they intended on retiring. And so we're responding to that.
Obviously, you're not immune in Bellevue to some of the activism, not just here in the region, but across the country and the conversations around policing. You've been talking a lot about it, just like everybody else in the industry or in policing. You certainly understand the frustrations that officers are feeling. Why would someone want to be a police officer right now? If they're thinking to themselves, is it worth the hassle? What would be the answer?
That's a great question. And yes, I am very aware of what our officers are feeling because I'm feeling it too. And so I will personalize this. My son, who separated from the Marine Corps about a year ago and just rejoined the reserves, he did 6 years in the Marine Corps,
nice,
working at the embassies, and he wants to be a police officer. And when he and I have talked about it, I asked him why, and he says, Dad, I feel called to do it, and I want to serve people in that way. And we talked about all the, you know, current situations in our country and all the dangers associated with being a police officer. And for him, as it was for me, as it was for my father before me, it's a calling, you know, and I think that calling will always be there. But for some, I know it's a difficult decision. I still think, Jason, that this is the most noble of professions in our country. I think that people who enter into our profession find great satisfaction in knowing that they actually help people.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a difficult time period. There's a lot of focus on policing, and I understand that. But my hope is that, you know, the manner in which the profession has been demonized by some will stop, because we're not that. By and large, most police officers across the country will go their entire career without any significant use of force in their career. Certainly, you know, pulling the trigger and using deadly force. It's difficult times right now, and I think we'll get through it. But what it takes, Jason, is dialogue, not yelling and screaming at each other, not pointing the finger, but actually sitting down and having conversations, getting things out on the table, and moving forward together. And my hope is that that is what we will start seeing.
Yeah, and part of that is pushing aside, in a lot of ways, the bad faith folks and focusing on the good faith ones who actually want to have conversations and talking about the real issues. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing over in Bellevue. It's really refreshing in a world of defunding the police that you are funding an increase to the pay of these officers. So anyone who's looking to become an officer, including the folks who maybe are a little bit unhappy with the situation they currently find themselves in, the Bellevue Police Department is actually hiring. Police Chief Steve Milette, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely. You've been listening to The Jason Rancho. Thank you so much for tuning in. Really do appreciate it, as always. I will see you on Monday. Hope everyone has a great weekend. Coming up next, Ben Shapiro.